I got rid of my apartment and moved into the office because we had cubes and space for 20 something people. We were down to 7. So we just had a lot of empty cubicles. And so I took a set of 3 that were kind of in an L shape and made that into my apartment. And I just hid my clothes in the drawers and set up in a way where if all the drawers are closed, it just looks like any office cubicle. And then when I needed to at night, I had like a little fold out mattress and sleeping bag, and I could just go in and sleep there.
Welcome to Rock the Boat. We're your hosts, Lucia Liu and Lin Gui. Together, we have candid conversations with Asian Americans who are challenging the status quo. We uncover stories about their upbringing, their relationship with family, Asian identity, and their work. In the past, we've interviewed Andrew Yang, Michelle Phan, and the Fung Bros. This season, we're featuring Asian Americans who have overcome challenges against all odds. Join us for our boldest season yet. When you think of serial entrepreneurs, who do you think of? Perhaps it's the eccentric Sir Richard Branson, who started a record label, an airline, a telecommunications company, and much more. Perhaps you think of Elon Musk, the creator of SpaceX, The Boring Company, Tesla, and SolarCity. It takes a certain type of person to start multiple businesses. We usually think of that person as an extrovert, someone who isn't afraid to fail. He's someone with a great vision from the start and who either has immense technical expertise or someone who is charismatic and really great at selling. When we think of great entrepreneurs, oftentimes we think of males. We think of white men in their late 40s or young white men who are dropouts from prestigious universities. But the serial entrepreneur we speak with today are none of those. His name is Patrick Lee. Patrick is best known for being the co-founder of Rotten Tomatoes, the popular movies rating site. The company survived the dot-com bubble, became profitable, weathered through 9/11, and successfully exited at a profit. Before we dive into Patrick's story, here's a quick word from our sponsors. This episode of Rock the Boat is brought to you by our seasonal sponsor, Numa Foods. Numa Foods makes good-for-you, chewy, milk-based candies. The recipe is inspired by Asian nougat candies, and it boasts 40% less sugar, 4 grams of protein, and a whole host of vitamins. The milk chews come in 3 different flavors, original, chocolate, and strawberry. My personal favorite is the original. It resembles white rabbit candy with peanuts and fruit. I recently spoke with Joyce over the phone. Joyce is the founder of the company, and she told me that the idea for Numa Foods came about when she was craving something sweet but healthier. Because she was sensitive to sugary snacks, her mother started hand-making these milky, chewy, sweet treats, and Numa Foods was born. Joyce and her mother launched the company in 2018 on Kickstarter. They received almost 600 backers, and they were featured in Projects We Love on Kickstarter. You can check out Numa Foods on their website. That's NumaFoods.com. Numa Foods is offering Rock the Boat listeners a free bag of milk chews. Just pay for shipping. Use code ROCKTHEBOAT, that's one word, ROCKTHEBOAT, to redeem. Now, back to the show. Prior to interviewing Patrick, I had no idea that the founders of the popular movies rating site was a team of Asians. It wasn't until I met Patrick in person on a quick trip to San Francisco that he started introducing me to his network. And I realized a lot of well-known household products and companies were either founded or co-founded by Asians. Companies like Away Luggage, Kickstarter, DoorDash, Crunchyroll, Guitar Hero, Twitch TV, Credit Karma, YouTube, Yahoo, Zappos, Patreon, and the list goes on and on. This leads me to question, why don't we hear more about Asian founders and their stories? Why aren't they building brands for themselves, like other Silicon Valley founders who are more widely known? Perhaps it's a mentality that we have to stay in our own lane and worry about ourselves, We worry internally about our businesses as opposed to looking externally. We don't use our businesses as platforms. We just think of it as a means to an end. We have to strive to make our businesses the best they can be and hide behind the brand that we've built. Patrick and I speak extensively about how that mentality led to his lack of a network and mentors, and how ultimately it was detrimental to the sale of Rotten Tomatoes.
I'm Patrick Lee. I was born in LA, grew up in Maryland, moved there when I was 5, went to school at UC Berkeley, studied cognitive science, left school after 2 years to do a couple of different startups, eventually took another 10 years to finish the last 2 years worth of school, so it took me 12 years to get my undergrad, done 6 different startups, 4 in the Bay Area, 1 in China, 1 in Hong Kong, and now I'm just kind of taking a break, trying to figure out what's next, seeing friends and family, doing a lot of speaking, organizing events with interesting people, things like that.
Patrick was a shy kid growing up. He didn't have a lot of friends because he moved around a lot in elementary school. He was always the new kid. Patrick and I bonded over that. We both moved around a lot as kids, and we both lived in Maryland for a while. I can see Patrick's journey reflected in my own. As an only child who was always the new kid, I would always try to organize my friends around activities. I held birthday parties, I had sleepovers, I loved working on school projects with them. And in high school, I even started our first drama club. For Patrick, he became the de facto community organizer amongst his friends. He jokingly calls himself, quote unquote, the leader of the nerds.
In high school, every year for my birthday, we would do a sleepover. So friends would come and they'd bring over their game systems and we'd pull down an extra TV or two to the basement and it'd just be playing games, pizza party, people would be up till, 2 or 3 in the morning, pass out, wake up, play some more games until, their parents picked them up the next day. And it would be, I think, about a dozen people, maybe up to 15 or so each time. And I just always liked that feeling of, I think pulling everyone together was also a feeling of belonging.
Patrick's ability to organize people and his desire to keep his friends together became the through line in Patrick's career as a serial entrepreneur.
It was one thing that I liked pretty early on was to try to get people together and just to have community. Mm-hmm. And I think all the startups I ended up doing were sort of just an offshoot of that. It was more about pulling people together to do something, and they just became companies.
Patrick ended up attending UC Berkeley for college. The reason, again, to feel a sense of belonging.
When I was growing up in Maryland, there weren't many Asian people in my elementary school. For junior high and high school, we had the magnet program, so there was a lot more Asians then. When I went to Berkeley, it was because it was like 40% Asian, and I wanted to be kind of a place that I felt more like I belonged.
Patrick even convinced one of his friends to attend Berkeley with him, and it was at Berkeley that his first entrepreneurial venture was born. He convinced a few of his friends to leave school and start a business.
The first business, we did it out of our apartment in college. Mm-hmm. There was 4 of us total. We would get orders from the internet or Usenet, go out, place orders down in the South Bay, drive down, pick up the parts, and if it was a computer, build the computer, and then they would come and pick it up and pay for it then. And it was not bad. The biggest thing we did was we actually managed to get a deal with UC Berkeley, where we provided, I think it was like 60 computers to them. And so we actually had to have our own little mini factory line where each person was kind of building something and passing it along because we had pretty big deliveries.
The company Patrick started with his friends out of his dorm room was called Human Ingenuity. He and his college friends would sell and assemble computer components by hand. Patrick made it clear that he didn't do it for the money. It was more so to learn the ropes of running a business.
I think for us to start that first company too was more about to start a company. It wasn't specifically computer retail. I don't think any of us had an incredible passion for it. It was just more like, hey, let's do something. And it was more about trying to start a company.
How did your parents feel when you started your first thing selling computer components with friends?
My mom really wanted me to finish school. She didn't have a problem with me doing a startup, but she wanted me to finish school first. My dad was just like, oh, that's cool.
Eventually, the business no longer made sense. Prices for computer components kept dropping, and holding inventory became a risk. Things weren't great with his co-founders, so Patrick knew it was time to leave. He turned his attention to a graphic design company his friend started. They both borrowed some money from family and rented an office in Berkeley.
When I came on board, we sort of reformed as Design Reactor, and it was still kind of around web design. Originally, we were doing web design, print design, 3D design for anybody. And it was very small projects in the beginning. It'd be like, I think it was like a dentist website, and we managed to get some jobs with like tech sites. So for like a motherboard manufacturer and stuff like that. In the beginning, I was doing more of like the sales and project managing and stuff like that.
The company was making some money, but not a lot, until a stroke of luck brought them in front of a big client.
We were doing stuff for tech companies. We were working on one called Tom's Hardware, and the president of the Tom's Hardware site was this person, Larry Barber. He liked our work, and he was like, why don't you come to Comdex in Las Vegas? I can make intros to other tech companies so you potentially can get more work. Also, my daughter will be there, and she is a online producer for Disney Channel. So we went over there, and we met up with her, and the first thing she said was like, we just fired our lead developer. Can you send us your portfolio so we can take a look? Maybe we might be able to give you some work. Problem was, we didn't have anything in our portfolio that really matched for Disney. And so what we did was, when I got back, I went and got a whole bunch of different friends of mine who were in tech, who could code or who could do graphic design. We all got together, and the idea was, we're going to build something to send to Disney to show them what we could do. So we looked on the Disney Channel website, looked at their schedule, and we found a movie that was coming up that they didn't have a website for, and it was Mighty Ducks 2.
So my husband is from Canada, and that's like his favorite movie of all time.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
He's a huge hockey fan.
Yeah. So we ended up going to Blockbuster, renting the movie, getting some pizzas, and we just had a little pizza party. We all watched a movie. And then after that, we decided, you know, let's split the work. And just different friends. I mean, a bunch of them weren't working for us at all. They were just friends that I pulled in. We built a fully functioning website. So cast, crew, photos, bios, icons, wallpaper, people's filmographies. We even had two fully working games that we made in Director, like Shockwave. And this was all in one weekend. I think it was like Monday after the weekend, I sent it over to the person at Disney Channel and said, look, we don't have anything in our portfolio that we can really show you, but we made this over the weekend to kind of show you what we can do. And she was just blown away, because she knew there's no way we would have known in advance. They ended up buying our two games, and we had to go and, you know, clean them up and stuff. At the time, we were charging, you know, $500,000 for the work we were doing. They bought the two games for a combined $12,500, and it was just way more than anything we were charging up to that point. And, you know, it was a good chunk of even the loan that we took from our family.
This was a big break for Design Reactor. They kept winning projects from Disney, which eventually led them to become their lead developers. These projects from Disney also helped them get more projects with other entertainment companies.
What would happen was, a lot of the producers at Disney Channel, they would move to other places, other studios and stuff. And they would take us with them because they knew that we would do a good job at a good price and we could make them look good. And so we got in with MTV, VH1, ABC, Warner Brothers, Artisan Entertainment, just all these different ones.
So at this point, Design Reactor was working as a business. Patrick had a team of 25 designers, projects were rolling in, and he had a working business model. So what prompted Patrick to take a leap of faith to start a new business? Well, it all started with a problematic employee who came up with the idea to post movie ratings online.
he would be working Wednesday, Thursday, pulling all-nighters, trying to get the week update out for Rotten Tomatoes. And he'd be coming in late or calling in sick. And even when he was at work, he would just be like super tired and out of it.
More to come after the break. If you are obsessed with basketball, you might have played a few pickup games and realized there's always room for improvement. Well, now you can check out Home Court. It's an AI-powered, augmented reality app that sits on your phone and it coaches you on your shots, your dribbling, and your movements. I chat with the co-founder, Philip, about Home Court.
I'm Philip. I am co-founder of Home Court. Home Court is a mobile basketball application that can help all basketball players get better and faster. You just need to put your phone on the court, use the camera to record either your shot or your ball handling. Home Court can give you real-time analysis and guide you on how you get better in real time.
How's your shot, Philip?
I'm actually surprised when I used Home Court myself to see how bad I was, to be honest. It was really bad. I mean, I kind of feel ashamed of it.
Well, did it help you improve it?
Yes, I would say, you know, kind of briefly, but as we talk to many of our users, they would say, you know, oh, I wish I had that when I was young, when I was more dedicated to basketball. And a lot of our users are towards the younger generation.
Yeah, and one of those kids, she actually got written up in an article. Her name is Lainey Grant. And she uses Home Court. Can you talk about like how you found Lainey?
Lainey's story is very inspiring. We wanted to find out whether Home Court really helped basketball players. So we look into our data and find a few of our most dedicated users, and Lainey is one of them. At that time, she has been putting up around 300 shots a day for a few months. She used to be very shy and very inconfident, but after using Home Court, she can see how well she does, and putting up shot every day give her a lot of confidence. And now she's a star point guard with very good shots in the game. For us, it's just so glad to see our product can help a user like that. We really hope Home Court can go along with her dream, and hopefully she can really become a great WNBA basketball player. We announced a strategic partnership with the NBA this summer. The biggest spokesperson for us is Steve Nash, for sure.
What was it like meeting Steve Nash for the first time?
He's one of my favorite players. When we talk, like, he immediately see how our mission aligns. Since then, you know, like, he gave us a lot of advices on how we can build shot science. That's one of our cool features, that it can track a lot of basketball stats, like release time, shot release angle, that you can't even see on human eyes. NBA has a very strong initiative to grow youth basketball. Our mission just aligned very well, and they see our technology as really one of its own kind to make it so accessible to everybody, every basketball player in the world.
So, whether you coach youth basketball or you just want to school your friends, up your game with Home Court. Check them out at homecourt.ai. That's HOMECOURT.AI. Now, back to the show. So earlier, we talked about the problematic employee at Design Reactor. His name is Sen Duong, and he was actually their creative director.
He was a huge Jackie Chan fan. And when Rush Hour was coming out, he wanted to know what everyone was saying about the movie. And so he went out and he actually gathered reviews. And back then, most of the reviews were not online. So he had actually go to the library, you know, pull out magazines and newspapers to find the reviews, write down a quote from those reviews, and then go back home and work on the site. He wasn't an engineer, so everything was static HTML. And the idea was basically, you know, you open up a newspaper, you see a full page ad for a movie. It looked like a movie poster with quotes on it. And the main issue was those quotes would always be good, regardless if the movie was actually good or not. And if the movie was good, the quotes would be from famous film critics like Roger Ebert. If the movie was bad, it would be like radio station DJs in the middle of nowhere. So his idea was just, what if I only put quotes from professional critics and I include all the quotes, good and bad, and then have a score? And so that's how it started.
Patrick and Steven, the two co-founders of Design Reactor, were a bit annoyed at first over Sen's obsession with his new project. But as the site grew and started to pick up traction, Patrick changed his mind.
I remember Steve and I were like, oh, maybe this doesn't make sense. It's like you're putting so much time into it. But at the same time, you know, we were hosting for him. We saw that it was growing in traffic. And there was two things that kind of changed our minds. One was Roger Ebert actually wrote an article where he pointed out his favorite movie sites for a magazine. And Rotten Tomatoes was one of them.
Roger Ebert is the famous journalist and film critic. He wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times and was the first critic to win a Pulitzer Prize. Needless to say, he was a big deal, and his endorsement of Rotten Tomatoes gave the site credibility.
And the second was when Pixar released A Bug's Life, there was a spike in traffic because back then there wasn't a lot of traffic. And when we looked into it, it was actually coming from Pixar. And so we're like, you know, if Roger Ebert's using this, if Pixar's using this, maybe there's something there. And so after about a year, I decided to go and talk to Sen and be like, hey, maybe we should focus on this as a business. And so what we did was we brought Sen on as a co-founder of our design firm, and we also became co-founders of Rotten Tomatoes. Then I went out, raised $1 million for Rotten Tomatoes, brought our entire design team over, which was at the time 25 people, and we gave our design firm off to another group to take over. So we could just focus everything on Rotten Tomatoes.
How did you make that decision to hand off Design Reactor to a group of other people? Especially since you were landing all these huge contracts and you guys were making money and you were clearly building a brand for yourselves in that industry.
It made a lot more sense for us to focus on Rotten Tomatoes because it just had more potential. There's a lot more upside there than joining a design firm. Plus, doing Rotten Tomatoes, it's like our own thing. We can decide how it goes rather than just building things for clients.
So Patrick and his team set their sights to growing Rotten Tomatoes full-time without the distractions of Design Reactor. Patrick raised the money in January of 2000. A few months after that, everything changed for all internet businesses. Here's a clip from Cheddar explaining what had happened.
On March 10th, 2000, the NASDAQ was worth $6.71 trillion. But the next day, everything changed. The dot-com bubble burst and the market went into a free fall. In less than a month, nearly $1 trillion of stock value deflated. By October 2002, the NASDAQ had lost 78% of its...
When it burst, we had to cut. Like, there's just no way that we could support such a large team. We ended up having to let go of almost everyone. We went from 25 down to 7. I told a couple of friends that were at the company, like, hey, I think we need you to stay because we need to keep running it as a business. But then for everyone else, we told them exactly what was going on. And we just said, hey, you know, you should try and start finding something. And we just kept people employed until they found another job so that there wasn't any real gap for them.
Internet businesses were going down left and right. Pets.com famously went out of business just 9 months after the initial public offering, and investors disappeared. Patrick had to lead the company to profitability or shutter the business. He decided to do something drastic to save the company. He asked his team to take a 30% pay cut, and he himself decided to forgo his salary altogether.
The way I did that was I got rid of my apartment and moved into the office because, you know, we had cubes and space for 20-something people. We were down to 7, so we just had a lot of empty cubicles. And so I took a set of 3 that were kind of in an L shape and made that into my, like, apartment. And I just hid my clothes in the drawers and set it up in a way where if all the drawers are closed, it just looks like any, you know, office cubicle. And then when I needed to at night, I had like a little fold-out mattress and sleeping bag, and I could just go in and sleep there. And it was good. I think I did that about half a year, and it wasn't really as bad as people would think it was.
When Patrick told me his story, it felt like I was watching a scene from the HBO series Silicon Valley. Sometimes reality is stranger than fiction, but Patrick looks upon those times fondly.
I don't think any of us really had any kind of real ego about things. We just wanted to do what we could to keep everyone together, to keep the company running. And so we weren't embarrassed or anything like that. If anything, I felt like maybe even proud of it. It's just like, this is what we're willing to do to keep things going. We got ourselves to break even. The site continued to grow steadily in traffic, in revenue, in brand. We never had hockey stick growth ever, but we just had consistent growth, you know, every month after month.
Things seemed to be getting better. The company was sustainable, users grew, and it looked like there was a path forward. Advertising revenue climbed for the site as well. They were running campaigns for big upcoming action films until something unforeseen hit once again.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
18 months after the bubble burst was 9/11, and when that happened, it also affected advertising revenue because a lot of campaigns got pulled or pushed back. And, you know, no one really wanted to see any ads during that time. I remember, I think it was Spider-Man, the movie was coming out, and they actually had to pull it and digitally edit out the towers because of what had happened. We actually had a campaign that was supposed to run for Spider-Man that got either canceled or pulled back. And so it was just a tough time because everyone was saying there's going to be the bubble's going to burst. There's going to be another crash in the stock market. They're also saying there's going to be another terrorist attack.
It was a time of fear and rampant paranoia. I recall the scene when I was still in school and I'd gotten to school. It was 7 a.m. I was on the West Coast at the time. And I remember the TV was on with the Twin Towers burning and one of the towers collapsed. It was a very confusing time, and it was a time that made people very cautious. A lot of people didn't even want to leave their homes for fear of a second attack. And so it certainly had an impact on Patrick's mindset about the future of his business.
We were trying to stay alive, and even things were getting better. We were always a little bit worried things like that were going to happen. I mean, it was just a weird time. So I think because of it, when we started getting offers, the first offers were like 10 cents on the dollar, 25 cents on the dollar. We decided we're not going to sell unless we can at least get our investors their money back. So we had raised $1 million off of a $5 million pre-valuation. So our final value, our post-money valuation was $6 million. So we're like, we're not going to sell unless we can sell for $6 million and make our investors whole. And that was the bar we had. And looking back, that bar was way too low. I think a lot of it was just a sign of the times. And, you know, everyone around us was going out of business. And we're just like, hey, if we have a chance to, you know, sell for a little bit above that, but at least get our investors their money back. And for us, we'll get some money and we can kind of pursue other options.
It was ultimately this fear that led Patrick to sell Rotten Tomatoes. In 2004, Patrick sold his company to IGN Entertainment. After the sale to IGN, Rotten Tomatoes went through a series of acquisitions, changing hands from Flixster to Warner Brothers to Fandango. Today, Rotten Tomatoes is a household name and is a top 150 site in the U.S., with 26 million global unique visits to the site. Looking back, Patrick had some regrets about the sale.
Looking back, again, if I had perfect information, I think we could have optimized the sale better, maybe continued running for a few more years, and then either sell to someone else or just time the sale a little bit better. You know, because I think we only sold for 10, which is not a lot. You know, when you have three co-founders and investors and employees at equity after tax, it really isn't that much. It definitely changed things, but it wasn't like retirement, like you never have to work kind of things. And I think though, had we optimized better, I do believe we could have gotten a multiple over that. And that would have been potentially life-changing for a lot of folks.
At the beginning of this episode, I talked about Asian founders who seemed invisible despite the prolific number of tech companies they founded. They seem to melt into the background of their brands and they stay unnoticed. If they are successful, we know of their companies as household names. And if they fail, we never hear of them again. They don't build a brand for themselves. How many Asian Steve Jobs do we know? How many Asian Larry Pages do we know? How many Asian Elon Musks are out there? Perhaps there are a few, but we don't know of them because these people focus so internally on their companies and they fail to be external facing. They fail to build a brand for themselves. Looking back, Patrick regrets not being more outward facing with his company. He takes responsibility for not selling Rotten Tomatoes at its full potential, which could have landed him and his team a significant exit. He attributes this failure to his fear of public speaking, his lack of a strong network, and his inability to build strong relationships outside of his friend circle. However, today, when I first met Patrick in person, I couldn't tell he was an introvert. He was on stage giving the opening remarks to a conference about the intersection of entertainment and tech. He spoke warmly to everyone in the room, and he helped introduce me to many of his friends in tech. He told me that what got him to be better at networking and public speaking was nothing more than practice. And this just goes to show that since he's focused on networking and public speaking, he has improved a ton.
After we sold, I decided I need to deal with this weakness of networking and a related weakness of just fear of public speaking. And so for the fear of public speaking, one thing I did do was I took acting classes. Two times I took these like beginner acting classes, but they were intensive, like 2-day workshops. And it was roughly around 8 or so people. And you were just up in front of folks over and over and over doing improv or, you know, getting a short bit of script that you had to act out or even try to memorize and act out, which was super hard. And for me, it wasn't about trying to learn how to act, but it was learning to like, what was that feeling of getting in front of people and trying to speak? And those workshops helped a lot in terms of helping me understand the fear I would have in that situation. And then on a related note to that was after I took those workshops, I was like, anytime someone tries to ask me to speak, I would, if it fit in my schedule, I would try really hard to say yes. And so I forced myself to keep doing it. Whereas before, my default was always no. And after I did it a couple times, I started feeling a lot more comfortable with it. At the same time, on the networking side, you know, I went out and tried to force myself to get out a little bit more. And then as I would go out and try to network, I started kind of coming up with my own little system of things that made sense for me being someone who's like naturally introverted.
One of those things was following up. Just making the extra effort to follow up with an email or a message after meeting someone. And if that person is important or if there's something that you'd like to learn more about that person, following up with a coffee date. While he was practicing his networking, Patrick soon found himself fascinated with Asia, largely because the technology in Asia was behind that of the US. He went overseas for 4 years. First in Xiamen, then in Hong Kong, where Patrick dabbled in a number of projects, including a movie film production with Daniel Wu, which then branched into an Asian MySpace for celebrities to connect with their fans. The company didn't grow as fast as Rotten Tomatoes, since the entertainment industry in China was still in its nascent stages. It was at that time that a piece of news broke, which brought Patrick back to the States.
We are interrupting programming this evening because an American Edison has died. Steve Jobs, the chairman of the board of Apple Computer Company, passed away a short time ago.
I woke up one day, I was in Beijing because we were kind of splitting time between Hong Kong and China at that point because of the partnership we had with the Chinese company. And I saw that Steve Jobs had passed away. And I remember he had that famous speech at Stanford where he was like, you know, every day I wake up and I look at myself in the mirror and I ask myself if today was my last day, would I do what I'm about to do today? And if the answer is no too many times in a row, you need to change something. And that's the first thing I thought of when I heard that. And it also struck me by how young he was, because I've always felt like life is too short. And he was only 54 or 56 or something when he had passed, which wasn't that far off for me. And I remember I was like wow, if today is my last day, I would call my family. I would tell them, you know, meet me in SF, and I would fly back as fast as I could, and then hopefully get, you know, 12 hours with them. And that's when I realized, I'm like, I have to go back. And so I started making preparations to, you know, at that point, find someone to replace me, to start looking to see if we could find a buyer, which we eventually did, and make my way back to the States.
It's funny that we work all of our lives going from one job to the next, one project to the next, one company to the next, and we forget the constant people in our lives, our family. I can relate to Patrick's feeling of wanting to spend more time with family.
When I got back, I moved in with my dad. My parents are divorced. My dad was in San Jose at the time. So I moved back with him, and I had barely seen him at all. When I was living in Asia, you know, my mom was in Philly at the time. My brother was up in Redmond, Washington, near Seattle. And so my mom would go and visit my brother about twice a year. And so I went back with my dad. And even now, like, we're both still in the Bay Area, so I see him pretty much almost every day and hang out, like, really hang out, like, go and get dinner or something, like, once a week.
For Patrick, he couldn't have been happier with his decision.
I've come to terms with, you know, Rotten Tomatoes will probably be the biggest thing I've ever done or ever will do in my life, and I'm okay with that, and I'm proud of it, and so I don't feel like I have anything else to prove from, like, a making my mark kind of standpoint or anything like that. I think what's important to me now is just friends and family and just being happy.
Patrick's not looking to do another startup, but he is interested in paying it forward to other entrepreneurs out there.
I'm actually volunteering as a mentor in Hawaii for a tech accelerator for 2 months. It's been a month so far. It's been great. And I'm working with a lot of startups. And one thing I've realized is I do like working with startups. I like giving them advice. I help a lot of times with, you know, making intros and stuff like that. So I do think whatever I do next, one, it'd be something that works with, like, the next generation of entrepreneurs. I won't do it myself, but if I can advise or mentor or speak or teach or invest, like, I think that makes sense. And the second is probably something that's still kind of sits in the intersection of tech and entertainment.
As always, we ask Patrick our signature question. What does rocking the boat mean to him?
Rocking the boat is, I think, just doing things differently than everyone else. You know, everyone, I assume, is just on the boat to have a nice ride, and someone who's rocking the boat is making waves and causing disruptions. And I think that's something that I tried to do with a lot of my startups, was just doing things differently, not taking the standard path, not just, you know, graduating from college and just getting some random management consulting job or whatever and climbing up a corporate ladder. It was something that I was never interested in and managed to convince a lot of friends to avoid. And, you know, hopefully more people out there will choose to follow that path moving forward. And maybe I'll be there to support them.
The moral of Patrick's story has so many layers. The importance of building a strong team, finding product market fit over just building a product, building a strong network as a founder, how much timing and luck have to do with building businesses, and how time is our most valuable resource. The point that I want to hit home in this episode is that as an Asian founder, I hope you can step up. Use the brand you've built as a platform to help other Asian founders, just like what Patrick is doing. We need more visibility into all the amazing things Asian founders have built, and we need more role models for our community. So please step up and be the next Steve Jobs or Elon Musk for our community. See you all next time. This season of Rock the Boat is brought to you by our seasonal sponsor, Numa Foods. Numa Foods makes good-for-you chewy milk-based candies. The recipe is inspired by Asian nougat candies, and it boasts 40% less sugar, 4 grams of protein, and a whole host of vitamins. The milk chews come in 3 different flavors, original, chocolate, and strawberry. That's NUMAFOODS.com. Numa Foods is offering Rock the Boat listeners a free bag of milk chews. Just pay for shipping. Use code ROCKTHEBOAT, that's one word, ROCK THE BOAT, to redeem.
Thanks to our writer, Jasper Chen, who wrote this episode all the way in California.
Thanks for tuning in to Rock the Boat. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes and help spread the word about the podcast. We really appreciate your help. Kelsa Lim is our assistant producer, Debbie Wong and Kim Hernandez are our social media coordinators, and Rachel Chu is our sound editor. Be sure to follow us on social media at RockTheBoatNYC.